Welcome to Agency of the Month, brought to you by CenturyLink on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Hello and welcome to Agency of the Month featuring the Department of the Navy. My name is Sean McCauley. Thank you for listening on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Carlin. He's the department head of the Office of Naval Research's Sea Warfare and Weapons Department. Dr. Carlin oversees science and technology programs for surface ships, submarines, and undersea weapons for the Navy. Dr. Carlin, thank you very much for joining me today, and I want to start with just some of the basics. What does it mean to be overseeing the science and technology programs for these ships and weapons at your office?
Absolutely, Sean. Yeah, let me put a little bit of context as well. So we're one of six science and technology departments within the Office of Naval Research. And when you look at the sea warfare and weapons side of it, I like to sort of get the short version, which is our primary mission is looking at the surface ship and submarine hull mechanical and electrical systems. HME is, I think, engineers quite often like to call that. And when you look at it, it's sea warfare and weapons, so the weapons piece of ours is actually the undersea weapons side of it.
Now, when you say undersea weapons, do you mean what I would assume is the obvious? Like, for me, I think of a torpedo coming out of a submarine.
Absolutely. Torpedoes. We also do countermeasures. Another piece of that over the years has been involvement in unmanned undersea vehicles as well. I think one of the sides of that is very important from when we talk about that weapon side of things is that my department really looks at very much so even in the ship side of these things is very much the engineering hardware pieces. I mean, sometimes I like to simplify it down to that when people kind of wonder, you know, what they would see if they were looking at the types of activities we do. We'll show them, you know, models of ships and submarines and say, hey, these are the kind of things we do. It's the actual things you can touch and use.
So that sounds like a pretty big scope in terms of what you're covering because, you know, every ship needs a hull, every submarine needs some sort of underwater capability. I mean, how big is the scope of what you guys are doing?
Yeah, that's it. When you look at the types of things that we have to cover, you're exactly correct. It's a very broad spectrum of the science and engineering side. And in fact, when you sort of look at how we break down my department, we come at it from one of my divisions, for example, looks at from a system standpoint, like how all these various pieces come together. But within that systems, you'll see the hydrodynamic pieces of that, the power systems being done, another piece of that. We look at it. We have another whole division that looks at it. We term naval materials. These are materials that are unique to operational in the marine environment, for example. There's certain requirements on, you know, corrosion and reliability and survivability of materials for ships and submarines that you don't really necessarily come across in the commercial sector and even in other parts of the Department of Defense.
Tell me a little bit about your workforce because you are covering such a broad spectrum of what the Navy needs. What does your workforce look like? How many different kinds of scientists there are there?
Right.
How many scientists are there in the first place?
Well, and the total makeup varies a little bit from year to year, but the core is 40, we call program officers. These are for the many of them have PhDs, all of them have advanced degrees, and for the most part as well, typically they have many years of experience in their particular areas. We'll have people coming in from, well, there's a lot of it's from the engineering fields, from the mechanical engineering, power systems engineering. We also delve into the science side. We'll have, I myself am a chemist, actually, and we have chemists, we have physicists, and they all work together to help address these problems. And that's very important. One side of this is very important to us is that we're all co-located in the same building. And so that ability to communicate to each other allows them to share their expertise across this broad range that's required.
Now, we're looking at that communication at a micro level, but like you said, this is one of six different departments within the Office of Naval Research.
Right.
What does that communication look like on a macro level?
Yeah, and across ONR, it's very much the same type of communication. The department heads, or six of us, the science and engineering side of that, and so we communicate fairly regularly, once a week at a minimum in our directorate meeting, but on a regular basis by just literally maybe just walking the halls, email, or picking up the phone. And I like to say though that where the collaborations across the building come together are at the program officer level, where the program officer from my department may come up with an idea that they want to link in with some of the other one of the other departments who deals with the area that we have to operate in, such as a battle space environment, might come up with that and actually put together a joint program that actually shares the expertise from one department with our own department.
Now, last week I talked with Mr. Nick Gurdon. He's the Director of Transformation for the Navy, and he works with something called Open Systems Architecture, and that's an acquisition strategy where you basically come up with projects that are modular and that are competed against within the industry itself, so you drive down costs. But the whole point is to make the system modular so that you can take a component of one project and be able to transfer it to another. Does that come into mind, like, hey, if I'm creating this fuel cell for this type of ship, would I want to create it so it can be transferred to other types of ships?
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, actually, because when you look at science and technology in general, and I'm familiar with the open architecture approach, and I sometimes like to point out, though, that a lot of this technology that we develop in and itself is open applicable. So you could argue if you want to use some architecture, you can, but the technology itself is quite often not developed specifically for specific platforms. We may have those in mind, be pointing towards those, but the reality is many of these technologies can be applied in different places. And if it's in some cases, we actually do them as a modular type of an approach. We've been doing some power electronics, for example, that we were long-running program in that for looking at power management for surface ship applications. But what's happened, because this is a generic high-end power electronics approach using a newer material, silicon carbide, many of the other departments actually are starting to pick that up as well. For high power radar, for aircraft power electronics, looking at it from the expeditionary side, and even very importantly for us, looking at it from the commercial side. Because if we can tap into the commercial side, we can get these fundamental technologies, these open architecture technologies into the commercial side, that will help drive down the cost dramatically for the military in the long run. Yet at the same time, we were developing things with that thought in mind that we know that it will have military applications.
Okay, so now we know a little bit about what your department looks like and sort of how you go about the way you're doing it. So give us a sense as to what you're focusing on right now. In your bio, you said you've been serving in the public sector for about 14 years. What are some of the big mission priorities that you've encountered?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I can even come at it from a department and a Navy side, and it even kind of fits into some of my own personal background and interest, is in the power and energy area. You may be aware that the Secretary of Navy has taken a very strong interest and the realization that energy is a strategic asset for the warfighters. And so there's been for the last, 5 to 6 years, a visible focus on power and energy. I will say that we've been doing this for many, many years, but with the Secretary's guidance, we've helped focus those in on those. And so we've been able to take the kinds of things that we've been working on and putting it into those frameworks. So I personally spend a fair amount of time on that power and energy piece, partly because my background comes from that even before you mentioned I was in academics and industry. So some of the things I was doing back in those days have been directly related. So I'm sort of a SME in those, a subject matter expert in those areas as well. And so when you look at my department in general, we are considered the lead for the power and energy focus area within ONR. We have a lot of the technical experts in there, but as I was pointing out earlier, our technical experts will work with technical experts in the other departments in applying those power and energy technologies to their type of needs. I think you mentioned fuel cells a little bit earlier, and that's one of those areas where we've worked very closely with especially the expeditionary department here, supports the Marine Corps, in looking at how these fuel cell technologies that we originally started developing for shipboard applications, and now really we're finding that they have probably more near-term capabilities for the warfighter in the expeditionary side.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about how you go about discovering these energy solutions for the Navy. I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Carlin. He's the department head of the Office of Naval Research's Sea Warfare and Weapons Department. My name is Sean McCauley. We'll be right back with Agency of the Month featuring the Department of the Navy.
It looks like the forecast is calling for a whole new cloud.
brought to you by CenturyLink. Get a visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions with CenturyLink, all built on a global, secure, carrier-grade network. And their custom solutions and support models are designed to enhance your efficiency every day of the week. Let their cloud infrastructure blanket you with security. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
Welcome back to the program on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My name is Sean McCauley. This is Agency of the Month featuring the Department of the Navy. I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Carlin. He's the department head of the Office of Naval Research's Sea Warfare and Weapons Department. They oversee the science and technology programs for surface ships, submarines, and undersea weapons. When we last left off, we talked a little bit about the energy needs of the Navy and how your department is working on a science and technology side to deliver on that mission. And I want to talk a little bit about the development process in general. When the Navy comes to you with a problem, or the other departments in the Office of Naval Research are creating a program and they think, oh, I have this problem and I need this sort of capability, do the answers to that problem, is it serendipitous where you think, oh, I can just create a new type of fuel cell and this could work to solve the problem? Or can you look at other existing technologies and maybe develop them even further in order to appropriate them to meet this new challenge?
I think it's a good point, kind of how the scientists and engineering minds sort of work. I think it comes in from different directions. When you look at if there's a particular problem or some maybe more important from an O&R standpoint, a future capability that we'd like to have for the warfighter, and how can we support that? So we'll just sort of open the box, open our minds up to see, I mean, what potential technologies areas could benefit that. And then we can come up with, you know, what we may think are the right ideas, but very importantly, we really reach out to the entire national science and engineering community to provide us with those ideas under an open competition process. So some of these solutions, like the fuel cell areas, I think were sort of a mix of a recognition of technology that's capable of being developed on the external side. How can we support that? And then where do we see that application? But of course, our interest sort of started even looking at that because we knew there was a need for much higher energy density systems.
Now, there's something I'd like to talk to you about specifically in a little bit. It's called the Energy Accelerator Program, because the Navy just declared that they're going to start investing more into that. But before we do that, I don't want to be unfair to all the other programs that you're working on.
Right.
We've been targeting fuel cells as a prime example, but what other examples can you give me are some of the ways that you're working on this?
Absolutely. I think one of the big game changers will be in it from a power system standpoint, sort of staying with the power and energy theme, is going to be some of the newer power electronics that are currently being developed here. And actually from historically, O&R has been one of the real leaders in advancing power electronics. A lot of the silicon-based power electronics came out of programs out of the Office of Naval Research. And so moving forward to more advanced materials that can operate faster, more power dense, operate at higher temperatures, these are the silicon carbide material. So a key to that piece is we can look at the range of energy sources, fuel cells, batteries. We work on batteries quite a bit. We have programs looking at turbine engines, for example, and high-speed generators for electrical power. And so we can feed all these things into our ship microgrid. You can accomplish that, but the real challenge is how do you manage that power when you look at what the warfighter will need into the future, particularly as we continue to move more and more deeply into electrical systems. You might be aware of the things that are happening at O&R around things like rail guns and lasers, high power systems that are necessary, high power radar that are required. Where we see the real challenge on that is, yes, to have those power capabilities there, but how do you manage that power and be able to provide that to those kind of systems at the same time using the same energy sources to power the computers and the phones we're talking on right now? So it's that type of piece, that power management, silicon carbide, we believe is a real game changer there.
Is there something that's maybe not classified, but something we would recognize out of James Bond, something that's extremely cutting edge that you can share with us?
I have to qualify that always a little bit, because a lot of these things that are cutting edge to the external, we've been doing for many years. So I sort of, I admit I get a little jaded on that. But I think when you look at, I hate to keep coming back to the silicon carbide, but the reality is that's not in the commercial market at this point in time. It's one of the next steps forward. And I think what's happening now is that grasp of that capability is growing as one of those major changes.
Excellent. Well, so once you've got these programs, these new technologies developed, and they go out into the field, how do you quantify what a success is?
It clearly depends on what the desired capability is. And if we talk about it from the let's look at it from the energy standpoint. And so there are several. I think there's several gauges of what we would call that we met that capability, which I think is the success, is providing that capability to the warfighter. If we've done that, then we've been successful. And when you look at it from an energy standpoint, one of I think one thing that people understand very well is just that if we can reduce the amount of fuel required to allow the sailors and Marines to do their mission, that's incredibly valuable. So that's one of those capabilities we see. At the same time, you look at it from a standpoint where I was mentioning high power capabilities, that ability to project power is an incredibly important aspect of what the warfighter requires. And that requires tremendous power capabilities, very short time electrical pulses capabilities to accomplish that type of goal. So in that case, it's not always fuel savings. It is I'll call it a warfighting projection capability in that case.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the main course of our conversation, and that's the Energy Accelerator Program that the Navy has decided to invest heavily into. I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Carlin. He's the head of the Office of Naval Research's Sea Warfare and Weapons Department. We'll be right back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This is Agency of the Month featuring the Department of the Navy. I'm Sean McCauley.
Let's get down to brass tacks. There's nothing more important than trust. CenturyLink offers cybersecurity solutions to the government. And the Department of Homeland Security has approved CenturyLink to provide enhanced cybersecurity services to critical infrastructure entities to keep you efficient and secure. As your trusted technology partner, their visionary cloud infrastructure, global broadband network, along with custom communication solutions and responsive dedicated support, provide the scalable solutions you need 24/7, 365. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
Welcome back to the program on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My name is Sean McCauley. This is Agency of the Month featuring the Department of the Navy. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Carlin. He's the head of the Office of Naval Research's Sea Warfare and Weapons Department. They oversee the science and technology programs for surface ships, submarines, and undersea weapons. And here on the home stretch, we're going to kick into the main course of our conversation, and that's the Energy Accelerator Program. The Navy has decided to invest heavily into it, and I'd like to ask you, Dr. Carlin, what exactly is the Energy Accelerator Program, and where does the Navy want to take it?
So it actually kind of ties in a little bit. I mentioned, you know, this importance of understanding the marketplace. Can we incentivize the marketplace? And I mentioned earlier about how within ONR, we do generate great ideas and even ideas for technology, but we're not a research organization. We rely on the university, the academic community, the business community, and our other federal partners in developing and identifying those technologies. And so, when you look at the Energy Accelerator, the way this is structured is, it's an ideal approach to reaching out to primarily the small business communities and looking to help them move forward. And probably the best way for me to do it is describe a little bit about how the accelerator works, if that'll be okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the way the accelerator is actually, let me tell you a little bit about how it came about also, is that there's a organization in the state of Hawaii called the Pacific International Center for High Technology Research, PICTR. And so we've actually been involved with PICTR for a number of years, supporting programs that funded dual-use technologies for the Navy and for the Department of Defense. And while working with PICTR on that particular program, they initiated another effort in the very early part, and which they called the Energy Accelerator, which sort of broadened not just to fund the small businesses, not just provide seed money or technology development money, but also connect those companies with mentors, which in particular come from the investment community. They may be VCs. They may be people who started their own companies. They may be people in the government who have a fully understanding of how, you know, technology can move forward from the lab to the field to, actually being a product. And it's that part of the Energy Accelerator that provides some of that unique piece. The reason they actually came up with this, which was they had looked at why small businesses were having difficulty moving technology from the, you know, into the actual marketplace. And what companies pointed out, and I think people in these in the corporate world know this, but maybe it doesn't get recognized all the time, is that yes, they need funds to develop the technology, and the Department of Defense has been very good. And other agencies as well, very good about providing those funds, like through the SBIR programs and other related efforts. But also what they needed, they said, was that network capability, those contacts, as well as someone to mentor them through that process. And so that's what the Energy Accelerator actually incorporates into this as well. They link companies up with established and knowledgeable mentors. They might be in the government if that's kind of a piece of that, but reality is many of them are coming from the venture capital community and the other investment communities. And so that really helps those companies to go beyond the federal funding so that they can actually develop a different sort of funding, I'll call it more robust funding, to take them from the technology to a product.
Well, that definitely ties back into your original mission, which is basically having these generic technologies that can even translate back into the private sector, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, one viewpoint is that there's no question that the Navy and the Department of Defense has unique requirements that cannot necessarily, will never be met by the commercial sector. At the same time, it's very important to recognize that many commercial products either can satisfy Department of Defense needs or can be modified to work for us. And I'll use energy as an example of that, because that's sort of the Energy Accelerator piece, is that when you look at it from a facility standpoint in particular, that there's incredible investment in all these different technology areas, whether it's solar, wind, fuel cells, batteries. There's a huge investment in that area. And while the Navy and other defense organizations have unique needs and may have to push the envelope of some of these areas beyond the commercial, the reality is, in facilities and certain other applications, those commercial products may satisfy exactly what you want. And so wherever it's possible, we believe that when we talk about the term dual use, I like to say commercial to military as opposed to military to commercial, because there's much more overall investment on the commercial side and the research and development. When you really look at this from the investment, I know people talk about the drawdown, but the reality is when you look at investment, and particularly worldwide investment, there's a huge amount of money that goes into that, very much so in the energy area. How can we take advantage of that? And that's how we see the accelerator. So by funding this, these technologies are going to move forward into the marketplace. That's our goal. At the same time, some of those areas that will be moving forward are of direct interest to the Navy and to the Department of Defense.
I'd like to ask you about those mentorships and how they work, because I get the feeling that those are not very common.
You're correct on that. I think what they did, and I have to be totally fair to the PICTR organization, is that it was actually the program itself was put together some initial Department of Energy funds, and it was while they were doing the Department of Energy program, that's when they recognized and talked to those companies. Actually, they pulled those companies, asking them, what do you need? And it was their needs that came about, said, well, we need to set up a mentoring type network with this. And so what we saw is, as the Department of Energy money was being worked through, we've stepped in to continue that and to expand on that. And I think if you read the stories, about triple the amount of money going in that was originally put into that. And A lot of it is because of these mentor efforts. So I personally have not been involved in the rounds when they've done the linking with mentors, although I'm aware of it, but I am going to join in the next round as it comes out this coming year. But what they will do is they take those companies, they actually will take them into Silicon Valley, for example, and introduce them. They'll hold a workshop where they will have the companies present to investors and, could be in, or you know, it could be from the VC community in that case. And at those kind of, at those types of meetings, that's where you can start looking at establishing those mentorships. It's not a, there's a list over here and there's a list over here and let's, you know, draw the dots, you know, connect the dots. It's instead, it's a face-to-face interaction to see where those mentorships and company needs can be really matched together.
Do you know how successful that's been so far?
Well, I think the metric they like to use, which I think is a very good metric, is that it was the initial funding, I think, was in the $10 million approximate, and through these connections with mentors and the workshop they've held, the companies have raised $38 million of investment monies. So really what you could make that equate to a 4-to-1 leveraging of the federal dollars.
Wow. And then that pays down the line depending on what kind of technology you're developing, because if it's something like cheaper, more efficient energy, then that also equates to who knows how many savings down the line.
Absolutely. And this is just – and it really, someone may say, well, that's just investor money. That's not product sales. Well, the reality is it's just in its first year. So, you know, it's not really fair to say that. They are going to be tracking, like, what ultimately in truth, as these things move away from the monies that the accelerator will provide, either seeds of $100,000 or up to $1 million for more product development, which has to be matched, by the way, by the company or some other source. As those move forward and the investments come in from the outside, the government doesn't need to invest in those at that point in time. Those have taken path towards product development. And so those will be tracked and ensured so we can get an idea of ultimately what came out of that. But at the same time, that frees up more money for us to continue investing and continue tracking. So you're sort of seeing part of this was also this, and I know the secretary has interest in this in the past, which was, you know, how do you get these companies from that, you know, people like, you know, people have used the valley of death, but, you know, maybe a gap is more important here, is that gap from that prototype to product, and how do you fill that? And it's difficult for an S&T organization to do that. It's not really our job. We may take it up to the prototype level. Where that nice piece of that can fit is in the investor community, people that are willing to put money into these products from the external world, where the companies, in particular small companies, who don't have that bankroll to carry products forward. Having worked in large industry, they have a product line. They can take that and make those investments. But small companies don't have that ability.
I'm curious to see how that goes. I mean, you said it's in its first year.
Right. And I know they've been successful in their first rounds. And I think if people are interested in the Accelerator website, it actually talks about some of those companies and the successes they have. And I think it is worth making certain that people are aware that the call for technologies is open until the 27th of September. And while it's a Hawaii-based organization, there's no requirement that a company be in Hawaii to do this. One of the reasons we're in the Hawaii part of that was because we have been involved in Hawaii as due to its strategic presence for the Navy and Defense Department in the Asia-Pacific region.
Are you sure it's not just because you like visiting Hawaii?
I can't argue that it's okay to visit, but it's a lot of work.
I have two questions for you. These are going to be tough, so I'm warning you ahead of time. One, so you said you were a chemist. Everybody always says that they can't pick their favorite child, but can you pick your favorite brainchild?
Let me give you two. One is that one of the things I think you mentioned my resume, so I've either been in school or was a professor or in various capacities with the university about half my life. And so I'm an incredible believer in the education side of things. And so we can call it STEM if you want. Some people like that. But it goes beyond educating K-12 and universities. It's in the professional workforce as well. So the things that we put together, and we have a number of programs that link our technology development programs with that education and training, And maybe that's one of the reasons I really like the Energy Accelerator, because that mentoring is that training piece. That's that education and training. So it has that built in as well into that. We've done programs where we do reach to the K-12, and where we have the kids working on like undersea vehicles that link them up with the kinds of things the Navy is actually doing. And those, ultimately, they'll even do internships at some of our laboratories to work on ultimately the more advanced technologies that they might have used in the K-12 aspect. So in general, the education piece is sort of one of my personal high priorities. And that's the general statement. And let me pick one particular program out of that we've just started last fiscal year, actually. It's our Energy Systems Technology Evaluation Program. We just call it ESTEP. And this is an example where we're having a pilot program out in centered around the San Diego area, but it covers up from Central to Southern California, looking at nascent commercial technologies, new commercial technologies or pre-commercial on facilities, on the bases. And the part of that, these are demonstration programs for the technologies. And that in itself is very important. And in fact, it was the Secretary of the Navy working with one of his special assistants that led us to develop this program. So the demonstrations themselves are very valuable because it improves the base in terms of their capabilities for their energy security. But a piece that we built into that, which I think is maybe, I would argue maybe the long-term value, is that each of the projects themselves are executed and managed by either military or civilians at the commands, at the bases. And very importantly, they also have a component where veteran interns can work on those projects. And in fact, what we've done is we provide funds, recent awards to San Diego State University, who have a tremendous veterans intern program already established, and we're accessing that to pay the veterans to work as interns on those projects. And so what we've built in then is the technology development, the technology demonstration, the insertion into the facilities, as well as building that workforce, building the workforce both from current civilians and military, as well as veterans who bring a tremendous talent and capability to the program.
My last question for you, it's sure. Real quick. Are you a football fan?
Yeah, I think someone will have to prep me for this question. It's an easy answer.
Okay, so is it Alabama or Navy?
Well, I hate to put against my Navy brethren, especially since I have friends who are professors at the academy. it's Alabama.
All right. So, well, that's where you got your bachelor's. I mean, that's kind of how it works.
Well, and to date myself, I was there, and Paul Bear Bryant was there. So it's hard. I didn't follow Alabama, to be perfectly honest, for many years till, of course, it became number one, like I'm used to.
Dr. Richard Carlin is head of the Office of Naval Research's Sea Warfare and Weapons Department. There's actually a lot more to our conversation that you can find online at federalnewsradio.com/agencyofthemonth. We talked more about the Energy Accelerator Program, and we even talked a little bit about Dr. Carlin's favorite brain children. But that wraps it up right now for the radio version. My name is Sean McCauley. Thank you for listening to Agency of the Month, featuring the Department of the Navy. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
You've been listening to Agency of the Month, brought to you by CenturyLink on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety at federalnewsradio.com. Agency of the Month, Thursday mornings at 11:30 AM, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Your source for federal news now.